Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
We have Dennis Stone with us for a unique Wednesday night show. Dennis has some updates from America's Stonehenge. Let's bring on Dennis first before we get into starting to summarize what the show's about. Hi, Dennis. How are you doing?
Oh, good evening, Mark. I'm doing pretty well, and thank you again for having me on this evening.
Yeah, it's this is exciting. You know, get to talk to you now that your first book is out. It's entitled America's Stonehenge, The Stone Ruins of New Hampshire. Okay, how does it feel to get it done and published?
Well, it feels really good. We've been at it for over 5 years now, and it actually started with my daughter-in-law and myself and another staff member back, I think, at the end of 2018 going into 2019, so it's been quite a while, and that's actually when we finished up our first book, but not really a full book. It was actually a souvenir book, and that came out, and it's been out for about 5 years, and it's been doing very well, so I would say this is my first real, you know, full book, but we did work on that one quite a bit, and it was much easier to do a souvenir book with captions and photographs. And I found out the process of writing a real book is much more expensive, more time-consuming, and a lot more put into it than I would have imagined, you know. So it feels excellent right now. So we're on to another project now. We feel like we've accomplished something, but it's been over 5 years, almost over half a decade now in this. So it's a really good feeling now.
Okay, good. And it is a family effort. You have four generations included in it. Baby Jay's the editor of it, but you have the whole family, you know, referenced somewhere in the book. So you're going, as we go throughout the show tonight, you have a lot of other people who contributed to it as well. So how did things go working with, you know, all your dad's records and Pat and Kat and Kelsey and everyone else from the family? Was that pretty easygoing?
At times it was very smooth, but we got into it about the second year COVID hit, you know, going in 2020. So my daughter-in-law took some time off, and that slowed things down. She could do some work from home on it, editing, you know. She was correcting grammar, spelling, that kind of thing, adding a few things, missed suggestions, that kind of thing. But it really slowed down. And then, of course, our granddaughter was born on September 11th, 2020. And the granddaughter, it was just an amazing, just to have her, you know, and she's part of the family now. But that, of course, actually slowed things down with my daughter-in-law, of course, you know. She was pretty much full-time with the baby for a while. So my son, you know, my son gave suggestions. My wife certainly gave suggestions. And one of the things I did after I retired in 2016 is start to look at all my dad's files. And we decided at that time to scan them, you know, digitize everything. And we actually began that project several years ago, probably about, I think you visited us in the fall of 2014. I was still working at the airline. But about 2 years later, we started on that. And that even got slowed down, too, because there were literally thousands and thousands of pages that had to be scanned. And I was doing that on my downtime, you know, when things were slow, particularly in the wintertime. But we never got through the whole thing until more recently. And we actually have a staff. Her name is Doreen. And Doreen's been with us for a couple of years. She had her own, a couple of businesses she ran. And then she kind of retired from that. And she was in computers, too. So she wanted to work for us, and she's a neighbor. And it's a small world because her brother actually worked for us from 1970 to 1974 with us. And so it's kind of a full circle with her coming back, you know, and working, you know, part-time in her retirement years. And she really got onto the scanning, you know. And I think what's left pretty much was scanning. And she did literally, again, thousands and thousands of pages of documents and correspondence and reports and everything. Are actually probably thousands of photographs, and they go back to actually the beginning, going back to about 1900, you know, the very first photographs. And some of it actually is negatives that have never been developed, you know, so those are going to be interesting to look at. So that's kind of the next thing we'll be doing. And since winter is kind of starting to wrap up now, we're getting into the spring, we're starting to get busier. We may have to do that next winter, you know, and that's the best time to do that, you know, that kind of thing. So she may do a little bit of it. And but I did find so many different documents from my dad's files. Some of it I was kind of aware of, some of it I was not aware of, and some of that we put into the book, which is kind of cool. The name of it, for instance, when we opened, I always knew it as Mystery Hill Caves back in 1958. But going through all the records and my dad working with a bank, and also when we incorporated with a state, I guess, back in 1957 going into 58, it was originally called the Stone Ruins of New Hampshire. So the Stone Ruins of New Hampshire was the official name, and it went by that for a couple years. But in 58 and 59, that winter, going into the second season, they officially changed the name to Mystery Hill Caves. So that's on my book. It says America Stonehenge and the Stone Ruins of New Hampshire. So I wanted to bring a little bit of history into it. And something I didn't really know, you know, I was probably about 3 or 4 years old when they started getting the business together. But I first visited the site with my family back in 1955. I was about a year and a half old, so I've been with it my whole life. But that Stone Ruins in New Hampshire thing, one of the things I found, and it was actually a whole thing on that, a whole file on that, you know, being incorporated and all that stuff and all the bank records and everything. And even some of the things that were printed later on still carried that name for a while. So it would be Stone Ruins in New Hampshire for a while, doing business as Mystery Hill Caves. By 1963, they dropped the word caves, you know. So we have all of that in the book. And the reason we dropped the word caves, it confused people. They thought there were natural caves in the rock, you know. And there's actually a definition of what a cave is. You know, those cabins and these caves. And people were kind of thinking they're going to go see, like, the polar caves, which is a big attraction in New Hampshire. But ours are man-made structures, you know. So that name changed at that time. But, yeah, the book does contain a lot of other different things that I think the public would be interested in, things that we haven't really talked about for decades and decades, and things I just didn't know. So we put a lot of that into the book. It's been a lot of work, actually. My daughter-in-law helped me. We also have one of our full-time staff, James Wakefield. He started with us in high school. He went to 4 years of college, and he graduated with a degree in law enforcement. He took philosophy as a minor. And going into his senior year, he asked if he could, if we could take him on full-time. We were quite surprised because his line of work would be as much required, and he had a lot of offers, but he wanted to stay with us. So I and my wife did, she put him on my book and said, we got to get this thing finished. So he was a school editor at his college, and he took writing courses. I did too, but it was so long ago. It was back in the 70s, so it was a big help to have James on. So between my daughter-in-law and James, my wife pushing the whole thing, and Doreen doing the scanning, we had kind of a team effort, because my granddaughter, Baby Jay, was there coaching us along too. So it was definitely a family and kind of a staff thing, So I'll tell you what, just in the last couple of days, we finished it, and everybody breathed a sigh of relief after all these years,
One of the things I wanted to focus on is the collaborative efforts. And, one of the themes of the book is, not really confronting the debunkers, but, you do devote most of the book to about 90 years of the scientific testing that does confirm the antiquity of the hill. You do go into some of the geology of the area, such as the fault line and the earthquake lights. We see some similar features with the positioning of the stone circles in southern England, and when you were a guest with Maria Wheatley, the two of you discussed that, but, just to recap for some of the new listeners, what interested you enough about the local geology and how it's changed over time, and why it's so important to understanding, the location of the ceremonial site on a hill?
A lot of the ancient sites we do find are, not all, but a lot of them are set on top of hills. Some people think perhaps it was to put the site closer to heaven, more prestigious, up high kind of thing. A lot of the megalithic sites are in Europe that I've seen are either on little hills or on bigger hills on top. There have been a few that are not like that, too. But that's one of the things. But the hilltop, we think astronomically, the way the hill is set, it's about 360 feet above sea level. However, surrounding us are hills that are just slightly higher than our hill. Some people mistakenly think ours is the highest hill in the region. But the hills around us are actually a little bit higher. They form like a rim around the site. And about a half a degree up, because we had it all surveyed starting back in 1973, and that was for research on the alignments. So we surveyed the alignments, the walls, and also the horizon, and that was important astronomically. If you're looking up about a half a degree or so at an alignment, you'll see the sun a little bit smaller than when it's right on the horizon. The same thing is true of the moon. It makes for a slightly more accurate alignment. And we recognized this 50 years ago, actually. And if you're looking at a star alignment, only about three stars actually touch the horizon The dimmer ones won't touch the horizon. The atmosphere absorbs the light before it does. It's like called extinction. And so with a half a degree uplook, you'll be able to see a few more stars. In fact, we think there are 24 of them, 23, I should say, that might be touching the horizon over certain stones during the course of a year. And this is all part of the research that's been going on since actually 1965 when we first opened up the First Avenue. But geologically, we're next to a river called the Spigot River on the west side. And just above the river is a glacial cliff shelter. So in the 50s and early 60s, they did excavations and they found pottery. And the pottery dated to about between 2000 roughly and 2500 years old. It was middle woodland period pottery. And that was a glacial cliff shelter, probably used during the season of summer, maybe spring and fall. Northwesterly winds will come in there. And it would keep the people that were there cooler for the winds coming in from Canada, kind of, you know. And by wintertime, we think they may have moved to the other side of the hill. And in the 1990s, in 1995, doing a shovel test pit, down near the parking lot, we found the remains of a wigwam site about 30 feet across. And the wigwam is actually above what would have been a pond. So geologically, it's changed. Today, it's wetlands. But, you know, going back around the time of Christ, roughly, and a little bit towards this side of that time period, because we have three carbon datings, and it dated from about 1,300 years old to about 2,000 years old. And the middle one, I think, was around 1,700 years old. So that area may have been occupied on and off by different people. Obviously, one wigwam would last more than a dozen years or so before it decays, you know. But it was a habitat site, and they were right next to a pond. But today, you look in there, it's woods and it's wetlands. It's not the same environment, you know. So that has changed. But we do have an earthquake. It's called a joint, actually, that runs right through the entire hilltop. It bisects the hill, and it bisects what we call the main site. It goes east to west, and it's a branch from what we understand of what's called the Clinton-Newbury fault line. It goes from Newbury, Massachusetts, up near the shore, north of Boston. It's on the shore near the Merrimack River, all the way down to Clinton, Massachusetts. It runs about 6 or 7 miles to the south of us, but one branch comes up, and that's the branch of this particular, you know, fault or joint. And so the whole hill is split in half. And the thought is if you bend quartz, you get energy out of it, perhaps even lights, luminous lights. That's one thought, you know, piezoelectric effect. And we do know, like, I've been to Delphi, and Delphi has a fault line running through it. But that's a little different. They think that gases came out of that fault. And somebody like an oracle, a female oracle, I think in that case, would inhale these fumes coming out of the earth. And it would be mind-altering for these oracles, you know. I don't know what it did to your mind, but supposedly that's what happened there in Delphi. But also Machu Picchu has a fault going through it. And you mentioned Maria Wheatley. I've done a couple shows. I stay in touch with her. She'll be in Chaco Canyon doing a lecture this summer, and she's going to try to come to our place in 2025 and bring her group. We're still discussing that. It'll be very exciting. But I did a couple of shows, and she talks about some of the circles, as you mentioned. And they kind of go from Wales into England, also up in Scotland. There's many circles, about 700 or so in each country. It's all part of Great Britain, actually, though. But so the ones in Wales are within a mile and a half or on top of the fault line, every one of them, I guess, that they've looked at. And the ones in Scotland, I got to ask Maria about those because I've been to Scotland and Wales, but I haven't heard whether they're sitting on fault lines too. So maybe the geology of the site, besides the astronomy, the nearby river, which would have served as a kind of a highway back then, you know.
Right.
And also maybe something to do with some mystical, you know, maybe they saw a luminous, if there was earthquakes and stuff like that, because we have actually a printout back to about 1658, I think it was, from Harvard University, from their geological department, of earthquakes with a magnitude and epicenter. And that's before a seismograph, so they must have been able to estimate these somehow and figure it out. But, for instance, 1727, there was an earthquake just to the east of our site, several miles, and it caused immense destruction in this area. Rivers flowed backwards. Sand came out of the ground. Places caught on fire. People were using, candles to light their homes or kerosene lamps, so places caught on fire. And it said the attendance in church right after that went way up. So I think people were pretty scared by this. That's only one of them because it had aftershocks for a year, that 727. But there are other earthquakes recorded too. And that may have caused damage to our site. But it would be also, I'd hate to see it, but if one happens, I'd like to be up there to see if you see any of those luminous, I've never seen that, either ball, lights, orbs or something like that, but that's what people say, it happens. And the site, it's near two Native American trails. One's called the Pentucket and one called the Pawtucket. The Pentucket is to the east of us about 3 miles, and the Pawtucket is beyond the Spigot River, maybe about a mile from the site. So our site was kind of near the Spigot River, which could be used as a highway. In the wintertime, you could walk on ice too, And that river actually goes into the Merrimack, one of the biggest rivers in New England. It goes from the seacoast all the way up towards the lakes region of New Hampshire. So that was one kind of a highway system. And then they actually had the trails, So I think the geology is very important in our site. We have glacial boulders. Some of them were actually used in some of the chambers construction, like the watch house or the oracle chamber. One thing we found more recently is they seem to connect some of these boulders, these glacial erratics, where they laid by the glaciers, tens of thousands of years ago, but they actually connected them with walls. They actually run a wall, a stone wall, man-made wall, over to a glacial boulder, and then it would veer off in a different direction and kind of go to another glacial boulder, and then it would zigzag over to another one. My wife called that the rosary bead wall. That was what she referred to it kind of as. But these same things exist in other places in New England too, like North Stonington, Connecticut has that. And there's so many other sites that have that similar feature. So they were kind of looking at the geology, these big glacial erratics and the earthquake fault line, which, by the way, for the people who haven't been to our site or haven't seen photographs, you can actually see that joint. It's pretty big. It goes right across the hill. And several years ago, I was on the glacial cliff shelter I mentioned earlier, and I was looking, and I looked up, and I saw where the fault goes right through the cliff, too. The cliff is kind of split right in half, too, because it just continues, it goes probably for miles in either direction, So that was kind of interesting, yeah. So the geology is very important. The other thing is, how big were the rivers back then? How big was the Spigot, going back thousands of years ago? A whole town of Salem, New Hampshire, actually was under what was called Lake Methuen at the end of the glacial age. It was a big lake that came right up to the bottom, the southern part of our land. It came right up near there. And then eventually, because the land rebounds, when you take about a mile of ice or so off the land, it has been compressed down maybe between a quarter and a half a mile. When you get rid of all that weight, it's going to slowly start coming back like a sponge. And it has been. And at some point, that big lake, the natural dam it had actually burst because the water level was changing, everything was rising, and I guess the pressure or whatever just burst it, and all that water went into the Merrimack River and rushed out to the ocean. And today that's where the Spigot River runs right through there. On the east side of us, there's ponds, there's lakes and wetlands. If you go back several thousand years ago, before a lot of silting and before the land changed its level a little bit, we think that if somebody came up maybe from overseas, perhaps, to our site thousands of years ago, they could have sailed up the Merrimack River up to a city called Haverhill, Massachusetts, and there's a big bend in the river there. It's a really big bend, and that actually points towards our hill about 6 miles away. But that whole area between our hill and that river is all wetlands, and all you do is lower the land just a little bit and get rid of a lot of the silt that's gathered up thousands of years. And we think they could have navigated probably about a mile and a half from the site at that time, possibly. We still have to do more work on that geologically, though. So the whole area's kind of changed over time, It would have looked a bit, and the hilltop would have been bare, we think, 4,000 years ago from all the shovel test pits we did. The president of the Hampshire Archaeological Society sided with us in 1989, and she just retired about 2 years ago. She's on the front cover, as a matter of fact. She doesn't know this yet, by the way. She's in Florida now living. And unfortunately, we had her for a decade. She was wonderful. She knew all the New England most of the New England archaeologists and anthropologists, and her husband was a doctor of geology. Speaking of geology, he was a doctor of geology at Tufts University, so he was very helpful with this too, you know. So that's her on the front cover. And I was looking at Facebook tonight, and I've never met her daughter. And her daughter actually chimed in, and she has because of a different last name. She goes, "That's my mom on the front cover." You know, she was giving it like a little hot, you know. I think she liked it, you know. So that was kind of special. So on the front cover is our archaeologist, and she spent decades with us. And, again, she was with the New Hampshire Archaeological Society. And, you know, she's just a very, very valuable, you know, just a wonderful person and an incredible archaeologist. She has been trying to find a replacement, by the way, and it's so difficult because her colleagues usually aren't that familiar with stone structures. You know, it's either colonial or pre-colonial. And pre-colonial might be stone tools, utensils, weapons, maybe a burial site, maybe a domestic site, but generally not stone walls, standing stones, chambers, you know, astronomical alignments. It's just not something that they really are familiar with or, you know, educated in or dealt with, you know. So she's trying to do that for us. So that's kind of neat too.
Okay. So Pete, if people were coming off of the ocean, they could actually sail inland for still quite a few miles, and you know, for whatever reason, moored and you know, kind of camped out and eventually built a ceremonial center. So it does work out with understanding the geology works out with the time 4,000 years ago time frame.
Yeah, it does. You know, it would have been a different landscape. When I took a course in archaeology around the time my son was born, around 1989, and this gentleman that taught knew my dad, but he was also the curator at the Peabody Museum at Phillips Andover in Massachusetts, and he took us through the whole museum. It was pretty cool. But he was an he was a president of New Hampshire Archaeological Society at one point in Massachusetts. But he described the landscape after the glacial, you know, maybe around 12,000 years ago at the end of the Wisconsin Glacial Age, roughly around that time, you know, the landscape would have looked like the moon. You know, there was no vegetation. There was no animal life on land. There was no birds. And there was nothing in the water either. You know, there's no fish. It took time for all this to occur. And yet in New Hampshire, over about 100 miles to the west of us, out near Vermont, near the Connecticut River, the New Hampshire Archaeological Society has a site over there. They say it goes back almost 13,000 years. So it must have been pretty harsh conditions, and yet people did survive. They made it somehow. It's like I was shocked by that because the glaciers may have been retreating up towards Canada by then, but just below that where we are, it must have been pretty tough, you know, but they did. So maybe it wasn't impossible, obviously. Somebody, they were able to, you know, they were actually have families. They were able to survive. They were able to eat, house, you know, clothe themselves, have houses, and right near the Connecticut River. So that must have been, that river was huge too after the glaciers. It was called Lake, that was called Lake Hancock, I believe, the Connecticut River. It went from there in southern New Hampshire all the way up towards the northern New Hampshire Vermont border. It was a gigantic lake. And like Lake Methuen, eventually it burst, you know, the natural dam, it just gave way. And there was one a little bit, that was called Lake Hitchcock, right. And then there was a Lake Merrimack right on the Merrimack River paralleling that just west of us. So Lake Methuen, Lake Merrimack, and Lake Hitchcock. These are huge lakes. And Lake Champlain back then, you know, in the New York, Vermont, was like an inland sea. It was so big. So that the point of that is the geology has changed. It'd be kind of neat to see a time machine and really see how it looked different, you know, right after the glacial – when the ice started melting, you start to see the land again, you know. What did it look like, you know? So that's important to us, you know. 4,000 years ago, it may have been a warm spell, too. It might have been when the climate was a little bit warmer. They can actually look at different things to estimate how warm and cool, you know, things are, whether it's, they do look
the pollen
at pollen and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of thing. And if there's any trees back then, but usually they rot in New England. But if you go back to places where trees grow like the white pine out in Arizona, they can look at the tree rings and see what the climate was like, you know, like small, tight rings, dry, you know. If they're wider wings, I guess more wet, maybe a better growing season, maybe a little warmer. I don't know. But they could actually come up with all these things. It's pretty interesting, you know. But we were told that it's a warmer period when our hill was built around 4,000 years ago. And they actually named those little warm periods and the little cold periods too, you know. When the Vikings came over, around 1,000 years ago, 900 AD, 1,000 years ago, into Iceland, Greenland, and eventually into North America, it was actually a warmer period, you know, and then a little ice age hits around the, starting in the 1300s, and then Greenland was abandoned, you know, before the time of Columbus, Greenland was actually abandoned. It was just got too cold. And that, again, it's to do with climate, but also the climate affects the geology too, you know, with the ice and everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, maybe another person that we haven't really discussed in a lot of detail that you mentioned frequently in the book is Dr. Lewis Winkler. Can you explain his role at America's Stonehenge and you know what his legacy there and your understanding of what he found?
Yeah, so Dr. Winkler from Penn State, he had been at Penn State since 1964, and he taught archaeoastronomy, the study of how ancient monuments, for instance, or structures are aligned with the heavens. And there's a little bit more to it than just that. But the way we look at it is the way our monoliths and structures are orientated towards the sun, moon, or even stars. So that's what he taught in school. And he came to us in 1998. And he came up, he introduced himself. We were quite surprised. You know, I think he just showed up, basically. And my wife and I talked to him and everything. And we took him out for over to next town over, Hampshire, New Hampshire, for a dinner, you know, for lunch. Actually, it was lunch, actually. And we told him a little bit about ourselves and our family's involvement with the hill and what research we've done, particularly about the astronomy and the archaeoastronomy of the hill. And then he kind of gave a little bit of his bio, you know, his background and everything and what his interest in the hill was, you know. And I forget when he first heard about our site. That's a thing I can't remember. I wish I could go back in time and talk to him, you know. But he was with us from about 98 up to 2001 when he passed away suddenly from a heart attack. And he was just retired from, I think he retired in 1999, I think, I'm going to say, from Penn State. But his interest was to look at the kind of go back and double check the research on the solar alignments. You know, we have the four seasons. We also have the four frost quarter days. So he kind of went and he looked at those. He looked at the survey data to do that. And then he looked at the lunar alignments with the 18.5-year lunar cycle. Then he looked at the stellar alignments. Now, in 1973 through 77, we hired a professional survey team. It was Beverly Pearson and Associates. And they surveyed us as we could go. So we would pay them so much, and they would survey. And this went on from 73 to 77 when they completed 15 acres where the astronomical alignments are, what we call the four sites for all the sunrise and sunsets. And there's a wall that actually connects those all around. So they did about 15 acres of survey out of 100. We have just under 110 acres. And by 77, we sent it into the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics to analyze the data. And in 78, we get the results back, and they said due to the Earth's tilt, the alignments, of course, are off a little bit today, but if you go back to about 1800 BC, plus or minus about 250 years, the alignments would work. And that agreed with today we have about 16 carbon datings. And in 1971, one of the oldest dates of the main site was taken, and that dated to about 1800 BC, almost 4,000 years ago. So the astronomical data seemed to agree with the carbon dating. But one other thing they said, and that was interesting to us, you know, that date was wonderful. It was great. You know, it's like, wow, that's really amazing. Both astronomical and carbon dating seemed to put the site back to that time period, almost 4,000 years. But they said you have 24 star alignments, and we were not aware of that. We knew that we had true north. Today the star is Polaris. It's part of the Little Dipper. But 4,000 years ago, we also knew that the Earth's precession as Earth, it actually wobbles on its axis, and it's a 25,920-year cycle. And if you go back to roughly around 4,000 years ago, a star called Thuban was the pole star. So it was a different star, and we knew that. But the other 23 we didn't know. So Dr. Winkler really got involved with looking at those 23 stars, and he had a whole list of the stars like Taurus, Cirrus, Rigel, and others. Izar was another one that were the stars that they were talking about from that 1978 report, because Harvard didn't do the footwork. They just told us we had alignments, you know, and they left it like that. So he worked on that project. Unfortunately, at the very end, he hadn't quite completed his research on that, and then he had that heart attack and passed away, you know, and it was very sad. It was very sudden. But he did put out a 30-page report in 1988 at the end of the season, and then he updated it in 99, 2000, and 2001, I think, before he died, he updated it with the latest information. But he thought the site was actually built in three stages, too. Kind of like Stonehenge, you know, and that I think the first stage lasted about 1,000 years roughly, and then the next one I think was, I'm trying to remember now, I don't have it right in front of me, but I think
it
the next
like
one was like 1,000.
2000 to 1500 BC, 1500
yeah.
BC to 500 AD, and 500 AD to 1600.
Right, thank you for that, exactly. I know I'd have to flip through my book to find that. That's right. And he based that on astronomical data and carbon datings. He also used some other things to kind of guide him in that direction. We don't know if he's if what he theorized is correct. We'll have to do more work on that. And that might involve more carbon datings or optically stimulated luminescence dating, more astronomical research. But I think he kind of opened it up for that idea, you know, for people to look at this. And perhaps, because we've always thought that the site was built over a period of time. My wife, Pat, always says like a layering of cultures, all the way up to present day, back to the historic where the Patty family were there for years, and then going back to the Native American time period with the pottery, you know. Different fire pits have been found and dated. One of them was 1,300 years old, and I mentioned the wigwam site. And that's, you know, we don't know who the original builders are, but Native Americans have been here, as I mentioned, in part of New Hampshire, at least going back 13,000 years. If there were some old world visitors that came over, maybe they assimilated with the Native Americans, we just don't know. But Winkler, he did get that going, though. It's a shame that, you know, he wasn't around a few more years to really look at his work to find more evidence to support his theory, you know. Because he only was there, you know, like 4 years, basically, you know, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, and then he passed away. But he was very instrumental in carrying on the astronomical work. I can say right now he probably could use another archaeoastronomer. We did meet Dr. Alexander Thom. Some consider him the father of archaeoastronomy. We had dinner with him in his house, and his whole family. It was at a compound the family has over in Scotland. It's near Dunlop, a town near Dunlop. My dad and I went over there. But my dad had been talking to him since the 70s all about the alignments at our site. And Thom had been working on the Scottish megalithic sites since the late 1930s. And he was an engineer. He was a doctor of engineering, actually, at Oxford. And there's the engineering school there. One of the buildings he retired 60 years ago was named after him. So he spent about 15 years down there during the war and after the war, and then he retired. But he's from Scotland. He moved back home eventually. And I believe he was involved with the University of Glasgow, too. And his son, Dr. Archibald Thom, was a doctor of engineering, too. And my dad was an engineer, so they get along real great, you know. But Thom actually looked at the alignments over there, and both solar and lunar. And he also came up with a standard unit of measure we've talked about before, the megalithic yard. That's being found in South America, and also in some of the mounds in the southern part of the United States, in Mexico, at Teotihuacan. And in previous shows, we talked about We think we have that measurement at our site too, and other New England sites are being looked. They haven't looked at for a while, and some of the other ones they say are based on the megalithic yard. Because in the book you'll see a little quote by the first researcher, William Goodwin. Actually, it was his right-hand man, Roscoe Whitney. He was an MIT engineer. And when he was working on the site, they cleaned out the brush, and then they began mapping the site. He set up a plane table. He did profile plan view, cross-sections of the site. We have all that data today. But he said, I've measured every structure, you know, the height, width, and depth of the structures. I'm paraphrasing, basically. And he goes, this site, whoever built the site didn't either know about linear measurements or didn't, you know, whatever, give a damn or whatever, because it does not conform to inches, yards, or feet. And that was back around 1937, I think, 38. And whenever you build something, you have a certain unit of measure, whether it's metric or imperial, like we use today over here,
right,
or some other system. But so, yeah, Dr. Tom, he was an engineer, you know, and so and he was an archaeoastronomer. He was they consider him like the father of archaeoastronomy. So it was an honor to meet him and his son, Dr. Archibald Tom. They both passed away. And then to have Dr. Winkler come along in the late 90s and help us out. And that just brings up the point, we do need another archaeologist, and we really could use a lot of help with the astronomy of the site too, just to go back, look, verify. Because we found all these windows too, and we want to GPS them, but we don't know if there's any correlation between them, the way they're arranged, and maybe something astronomically. That's just not known at this time either. I will say one more thing, Mark. There's a wall called the North Wall. It's kind of a bow tie shaped wall, you know. It's on the west of the site, not too far from the summer solstice sunset stone. We've been looking at that for decades. We opened up the trail next to it in 1974. I got the report. My dad wrote up, he was an engineer, just wrote up everything. There's my name. There's the day where he opened up the trail or whatever. We cleared the brush. And so we've been walking by it for 50 years now. But I was looking at it last year. I was riding my ATV by there, cleaning up some brush or something. And I looked at it and I said, you know, I wonder, look at the shape of that. But I know Teotihuacan and the Great Pyramids on the Giza Plateau are shaped kind of like the Belt of Orion, you know. And so uh-huh. I've been looking at that, and I go outside, I can see Orion just about every night. It's not out tonight, it's raining, but I'm wondering if somebody could look at that, an astronomer even, just say, it's a possibility, or no, it's not correct, you know what I mean? So it's just something I've been very curious about, you know, since last year. Why did they build this wall? You have to see it. It's well built. It runs probably 100 or so feet, shaped kind of like a bow tie almost, but it's curved and everything, you know, like the belt is, you know. So it may not be anything, but that's another reason we need an astronomer up here, you know, to check that out.
Yeah, and you were just talking about the different dates from the shovel test pits or, you know, charcoal found by a wall or something like that. In the back of your book, you have copies of, you know, the paperwork from the labs. You know, you also have it on display in the gift shop and in the back of the souvenir book as well. So people can see all of the different dates from the site. You know, and that kind of takes us back to, you know, what Dr. Winkler was suggesting is, you know, approaching 4,000 years of occupation may not have been, you know, it was not just one settlement, you know, at 2000 BC. You know, people may have come and gone for, you know, a couple generations, but they kept coming back over a lengthy period of time.
Right. You had Jeff Wilson on last week, I think, right, Jeff Wilson?
Yes.
The Great Serpent Mound, and I know you know that pretty well, and I We were there last summer, and I think they were talking, they're arguing, I think, over the age of it. And it again, it might have been where somebody had built it, and then it was used, reused, and, you know, restored somewhat later in time by different people. Because I think they're talking somewhere over 300 B.C., Adena, I think, or maybe going into the Fort Ancient, like 1100 A.D., but they're still, I think they're still arguing. I don't know if they resolved that with more testing, but even a site like that, you know, and they get a lot more funding and a lot more attention. That site's still controversial. These sites in the Northeast really shouldn't exist. But I think we have a widespread of time that the site could have been used. We see where the site may have been modified by later people. Even one of the serpent walls seems to possibly have had a different design to it. And then it was kind of abandoned, that particular design, and it looks like they changed it. And we're going to run radar over it, the ground penetration radar, to see if one of the walls, I'm thinking, you can see the top of it. Is it an organized wall? If it is, it might answer that question, you know. We'll get the radar coming back hopefully this year to do a couple things. But I think it was a long time, you know, maybe, you know, a few thousand years of use. And maybe there was a period where nobody did anything with it, you know, abandonment. I know Stonehenge was 1,500 years, they said, it took from the beginning to the end. You just wonder if even at Stonehenge people walked away from it for a while, you know? I don't know, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting, you know, that can... Now, I might as well just bring it up now. You know, throughout your book, you include a lot of photos. You just mentioned the site being abandoned. You have a photo of where one of the slabs where one of the people, you know, staff members was taking her lunch break, and she, you know, kind of started wondering a little bit about the rock she was sitting on, and, you know, a little bit of excavation revealed that it had been propped up. You know, you showed me one of the photos like that too, or sent me some photos, and you showed me one of the rocks that propped up, and you said, you know, it's kind of like, you know, they're getting the rock out of the quarry, and they're getting it propped up, and, you know, they wanted to take a lunch break, and they never came back. And there's like all these rocks like that. You know, why'd you put all this work into quarrying a rock, and you never came back to use it? It just seems very odd. So, you know, why are people suddenly leaving? That goes back to, people being there, then for some reason they leave. But, you know, you do incorporate a lot of those photos in your book, and, you know, in Maria's book, you know, hopefully we're going to have her on soon. She has a lot of photos from the Stonehenge area, in Avebury, of the mounds, the long burrows. You include a photo of the fault line going through the property. So it just seems like, you know, with what you're doing and Maria's book, the publishing technology seems like it's allowing for more people, or you know, people to get a lot more photos put into their books to demonstrate what they're, you know, here's what I'm talking about. You know, there's a photo of it. I don't need to write 1,000 words to describe it. There's the photo. So, but you know, your photos really illustrate your point.
Yeah, we tried to do that too, you know, put the photographs next to a description or, you know, part of what we're trying to tell. Yeah, it's very, very visual. You know, it is worth like 1,000 words when you see this. And yeah, it's really easy to get the photographs in the books now. It's really, really nice, you know. So we tried to be very conscious of that, put the, you know, the right pictures with the part of the book that we're, you know, we're, when you're reading it, you know, the whatever the different research or investigation or whatever, it does tell a story, the photographs, you know, and of course they do go back to, I think the earliest, they go back to, we got some 1920 photographs here, and then we show some of the stone tools, you know, that people say, oh, you don't found any ancient artifacts up on the site. Well, the site itself is an artifact of some kind, but yeah, we show the, you know, the pottery from the cliff. We show historic, like the plug and feather that the quarrymen did in the 1800s, pottery from the pottery time, eyeglasses, thimbles, all sorts of stuff. We even have a headstone of the original Paddy that came over from England, Peter, and the great-great-grandfather of Jonathan, who many people, you know, give credit or blame for the site, you know, because they lived on it. But we actually found the headstone, and it was James, you know, my editor. He lives in Haverhill, and he was over there one day walking around trying to see if he could find this thing, you know, and he actually found Peter's headstone. He died in 1724, but he went from England to Virginia, and then he moved up to Massachusetts. But it was his great-grandson that bought the first piece of property on the hill in 1734. So, but, yeah, we try to put the pictures where they're appropriate, you know. I think it's kind of helpful.
They're a real highlight in the book. I just hope people, you know, will buy the book and will continue to listen to you when you're just on the radio with us, and we have to use words, but I really think that You did a terrific job illustrating the evolution of the hill, the old photos, from the Pearson and Goodwin era to how it looks today. All the artifacts, you have the canoe in one of the photos. I think you did a terrific job demonstrating how much all these researchers over the last 90 years have contributed to understanding what was going on at the hill for about 4,000 years.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much for that. Yeah, we have them. I just found the one that's 1900, you know. It was in the appendix under, for protection and vandalism of the site and that kind of thing. But, and I think even the windows, you know, we have, I think, one of the window and then the window with a shutter put into it, you know, which is very visual, you know. And then some of the other styles of windows, these what we call spirit holes. That's what they call them in England. That's what Maria Wheatley calls them. She just sent me a couple more pictures of spirit holes from England. Very similar. But she sent me a medieval church that has a spirit hole, but it was the back part of it was blocked up with some bricks. Originally, it was a hole right through the wall. So I guess the idea was that the spirits could go through that. But I got a couple cobbled windows, you know, with the little stone cobbles, including the last one I found last fall. Just riding by it for quite a while, never noticing it. And then when I was October 8th, I saw it, 2023, I happened to look at, finally caught my eye, and I go within 10 feet of it. And I said, that looks like a window. I got off and looked at it, and it had all these loose cobbles in it, just like one of the other ones near the summer solstice has the same thing, little cobbles in it. But some have Venetian blinds. So yeah, we try to put the pictures of, the different, whatever we're trying to describe in the, in each chapter, you know. And I think I think they're very helpful, you know, to get the message across of what we're talking about.
I do
about.
Too.
Yeah.
And if people like what we're discussing, they can get even more of you at a spring equinox conference you're putting on. Can you
yeah,
tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, thank you, Buck. Yeah, we'll have the equinox on the 19th. It's a little bit earlier this year, but a couple of days later on the 23rd, we're going to have a all-day event. It'll be on Saturday. And it's going to start with a sunrise in the morning, and we'll see the sunrise over the main stone. And then it's going to be off a few days, so it'll be off a little bit. And then we'll watch when it goes over a stone near the Oracle Chamber. Then we'll go down and watch the Watch House illumination inside the chamber. And we have pictures of that in the book, too. After that, we'll probably have a break. We'll probably have donuts and coffee available, a little discussion with the host and the guest. And then we're going to have my presentation, a PowerPoint, probably 45 minutes. Then we'll do a tour around the site. I'll take everybody on a tour. And then we'll break for lunch. And the next part of that will be, the guest speakers will be Scott Walters from America on Earth. And we've been on his show, and you've had Scott on. He has a new show on Gaia. I guess it's Gaia, Gaia TV. You have to subscribe to it. He's got a new series. I don't subscribe to it, but it sounds interesting, you know. We're going to have Ronnie LeBlanc. He's on the Travel Channel. He's a host of Expedition Bigfoot, but he does a lot more than Bigfoot. He does all sorts of other unusual things, and he's the author, too. He lives in Massachusetts. I've been with him on a lecture before about 5 years ago. He's a really nice guy. And then Haley Ramsey, she's going to be doing a talk on ancient, I think, megalithic goddesses. I'm not sure. I have to double check what she's doing. But she's a tour guide. She's a travel agent, and she's an author. And she took archaeology in school, dug in Mexico. She's traveled to South America. She actually lived in Scotland two different times. And she does these big, long tours, like 10-day tours over in Scotland. She's got one going over in Spain and Portugal. And she had one here a year and a half ago, went from Nova Scotia to Washington, and we were the mid-stop. But on the 23rd, she'll be doing her presentation. Then we'll have dinner. We're going to go downtown Salem, I think, have a nice dinner. And then we'll have a sky-watching kind of a, I guess, a UFO thing in the evening. And I think Ronnie LeBlanc's going to lead that. So probably sunrise in the morning, all the way to probably around 10 o'clock at night. It's it's an all day and a long day. It'll be a lot of fun, though. So that's on the 23rd of March. But the equinox is on the 19th. It's a little bit early this year. And then we got other things like drumming circles coming up this year. We have the eclipse on April 8th. That's actually filling up right now. We got people doing reservations, and that looks like if the weather's good, it should be great. It's going to be 95% here, not 100%, but 95% here. So on top of this hill, it should look pretty cool.
Okay. With the eclipse, what are people going to see from the hill? What it sounds like, it'd be a really cool experience.
Yeah, you can actually watch it, you know, anywhere. And if you go a little bit further north in the White Mountains, I think there'll be a lot of people up in Mount Washington and New Hampshire, probably, depending on the weather. You know, it's April, you know. But sometimes Mount Washington still has snow. And there'll be other places all the way down to Texas that are right on the 100%. But we're pretty darn close to that. So you're going to be in an ancient site on top of a hill, and we have these big open vistas now. So I think it's going to be kind of neat to be there, you know. It's like if you could be at Stonehenge in England or something like that, or the Great Pyramids, that's the kind of thing we'll have. You'll be at an ancient site, and you'll be witnessing this really cool, you know. It's going to be just, it goes about 4 minutes and 12 seconds, I think, under the 100%. And I think we're around 3 minutes or maybe 3 to 4 minutes. And we actually have a little kits people can buy, you know, the little glasses and everything at our site. We have special T-shirts for that day, too. Matter of fact, I bought one at the Great Serpent Mound last year. They had their eclipse T-shirts out already in the souvenir shop last year, and I bought one. I should wear it that day, but we have our own, too, you know. So we have a T-shirt, and we have a little you know, safety glasses you can wear, you know. And people are already making reservations for that. So, but just to be up on an ancient site, no matter where you are, you know, you could be out one of the ancient mounds out west, like maybe the Newark Mound, you know. I think that's going to be pretty close to 100%. That might be a cool place to watch it. Next year we'll have the lunar cycle, and at Newark site in Ohio is one of the places, but ours is going to be another place where we have the alignments with the moon. So that's in 2025, you know. But this year we got a lot of stuff going on. So the equinox, and then that special day with Haley and Scott, Ronnie, myself, and then we have the eclipse on the 8th of April. And then I think we're going to take off and do a little trip around some of the ancient mounds for a little vacation after that. My wife and I need to get away for a while, you know. It'll be kind of nice.
Cool. Okay. And I know you have to do some work in the morning, and you just want to do a super late night. Before we sign off, how do people get a copy of your book? And do they need tickets to get to the eclipse, or how do they get in to see the speakers on the March 23rd?
So the March 23rd is with Haley Ramsey's running it. So it's HaleyARamsey.com, HaleyARamsey.com. If you have any problem getting that, you can contact us, and we'll try to steer correctly at our website, which is StonehengeUSA.com. And StonehengeUSA.com, we have the information regarding the eclipse on there, and we also have an 11-minute video. We have a free app download. You can do a virtual tour of the site. Even if you can't make it to us, it's free. It's cool. You can do it from home in a couch. But people coming and using it, it talks to you as you're walking and has pictures and text. So our website has all that information for whether it's the equinox coming up. And we also have some information about what, you know, Haley and that group's doing on the 23rd. And then we have the eclipse thing, and that's all on the website too. And there's a phone number, there's an email there. So if you have a problem trying to get through the ticket for the 23rd with Haley, just give us, and we'll steer you right to her website again. But it should be HaleyARamsey.com, and she's handling that end of it. So for tickets for that event. So, but my book, it's right now. It should be coming out. We got five copies, just proofs, just to read them, and just they came in 3 days after we ordered, sent in the my manuscript. We made a couple more corrections, and we're hoping to see the book within the next few days. But it will be on Amazon.com too. America Stonehenge, The Stone Ruins of New Hampshire. It should be on Amazon, Kindle, I guess. I'm not sure how all that works. My wife knows more about that end of it. But I will try to find out more. But it will be available too. They have it shipped directly from Amazon. So, but we'll have it in a gift shop, you know. And we don't want to do a lot of mailings, you know. It's very time consuming. We can do that, you know. We can, but they can get it directly from the publisher, you know. So.
Okay. All right. Well, Dennis, is there anything else you wanted to cover? You know, we can let you rest up for tomorrow's projects in the woods, or we can go for another 57 minutes. Your choice.
Is there anything else you wanted to ask about anything, Mark? Regarding the book?
Yeah.
I can go for a few more minutes. I don't want to, you know, we work every day at the museum, you know, 7 days a week, so it's but I definitely enjoy being on the radio. You're gonna have to get back up here again and check out all the things. We do mention the forestry project, I think, in the in the book, why we did that, you know. And it makes the alignments so much nicer, you know. You can see all the alignments. It really opens up the top of the hill so much more than it ever was before. So that part of it's really good. We have some drumming circles coming up. We have some other people that are running some other kind of mystical, I think, healing, spiritual things on the hill, and that will be on our website too. But the next thing I'm going to be doing is updating my PowerPoint presentation, which I will be giving on the 23rd. So that's like we've been working on that just when the book finished that up, right into the PowerPoint. So I'm going to have a whole new PowerPoint presentation. It will kind of follow the book loosely, though, I think, you know. And so, which is kind of good, you know, it's kind of easier because you have all this material we've been going through. We're just kind of transferring it to a PowerPoint. And, you know, I enjoy doing lectures too. So maybe we'll try to do a few more of those.
Okay.
But you got a chance, well, you got a chance to look through the book. So yeah, is there anything, any other, anything in there that, struck you?
Well, yeah. I don't want to give away the whole book where, ruin the ending where the aliens come down and take over and make America Stonehenge or capital. But
you're giving it away now. There's no reason to buy it.
But
thanks, Mark. Thank you.
You do mention Tom Elmore's work there too. Yeah, that was, some more photography that he's done. I think when people read the book, they realize that for the entire length of time it's been studied, there have been so many different points of view, different scientific methods used. You cover them all. And I think that's part of the appeal of your book is there's just a progression of thought, backed up with the photos, the documents from the labs at the end of the book. It's a little bit of everything that we know that goes to, you to make the case that, this is a very old site. There, we still definitely don't know if old world people were the builders of it, but there is plenty of indications that they did come here. But, what was Tom's role in the research?
Well, Tom Elmore, he's from Suffield, Connecticut, and just about 4 years ago, he gave us a call out of the clear blue, and he introduced himself, and he told, I was on the phone with him, and he told me his background. He was a landscape architect with a master's degree, and that he had purchased recently at that time a handheld LiDAR unit. And he was doing some, he's going to use it in his work, but he also wanted to do it with some research on some of these ancient sites because he's in Connecticut, and Connecticut is loaded with many, many different sites, amazing sites with a lot of similarities to our site. But I guess he had been steered towards this site, and he was familiar with it, maybe from TV. I'll have to ask him because I talk to him frequently. But, he wanted to come up and see if he could map or scan, actually, some of the ruins, And I said, wow, that would be amazing, if you could do something like that. And the name of his company is GeoNat. We worked out kind of a plan that we'd come up in the spring once the snow was gone in 2020. And he came up and drove a couple hours to get here. And he came up. We got together. He showed me his equipment, explained how it worked. Then he got himself all suited up with his equipment and everything. And he began walking around the main site. And he had to go in a certain way so he could scan everything very carefully. And he finished up for the day, and he made plans to come back because he had to make several trips to do this. And he would send a little clip of what he did, like an image or whatever, and it was pretty amazing. But by, I think, December of 2020, he had pretty much completed what he wanted to do initially was the 15 acres that contained the astronomical alignments. And it ended up being about 16 acres. He got scanned, actually, from the visitor center all the way up and around. His equipment can see down to about 1 centimeter, which is pretty amazing. And it has 16 lasers. It has a high-definition camera on top. And he bought a new computer. He also had software that was made in Montreal, special software. The unit's made in Florida. And when he was done, he had to process all the data, and he later told me he spent 600 hours of computer time processing about the 16 acres, actually. And his equipment will shoot out about 80 meters, you know, as he's walking, it goes out 250 feet or 60 feet or whatever. So what we showed, it looks, we just couldn't believe it. On a computer, you can zoom into a chamber, you can zoom below it, you can go back like you're in space looking down. It actually looks like drone work, you know, when you're looking at it. So it was quite amazing. And from that, we were able to start looking at the chambers, the structures, and the different features a little bit closer, because it really mapped them very, very carefully. And the nice thing you do is you can select get rid of trees. You can take the trees and brush out of the image, and everything shows up so nicely without the trees there, you know. Well, probably the way the site looked 4,000 years ago. And one thing we sort of noticed is a trapezoid shape to some of the, like what we call the courtyard. It's where the Patty homestead sat over. It should be rectangular. And when you look at it, and when you go with your eyes and look at it later, you look at it, and you actually bring a measuring, you know, like a tape measure down there. You're like, this whole thing is not square. It's not rectangular, and it's not 90-degree corners. It's trapezoidal in shape. And if we go back to Roscoe Whitney, one of the comments he made back in the 30s was there's not a right angle on this site. And I'm wondering if that leads to the trapezoid shape, because it's not a right angle. It's, you know, if it was right, it'd be either a square or a rectangle, you know, any structure. The courtyard, and then Tom actually worked his way into one of the chambers. And I have a picture of that in my book. The roof slab fell into it at some unknown time in the past. It's about a 7,000 or 8,000 pound roof slab. But he was able to actually get in there with his equipment. He's got a kind of a he had some problems with his back. He just had surgery. He was out of commission for a while. But even 2020, he was having issues with his back. But he got in there, and I was pretty impressed by what he was able to do. And he actually mapped the inside of that structure. And I found out the plan view, looking down at it, the floor plan, I should say, is trapezoid. The patty chamber, which is another stone structure with a stone roof, that turns out when you look at it, it's trapezoid. So that's one of the cool things we found, you know. And even a little alcove near the sacrificial table turned out to be a trapezoid shape. So I think the whole site was built by the Patty family at some point. They probably used 90-degree corners. Everything would be rectangular like the house on top. But the slight trapezoid shape to it, the house can still sit over because of the silt. But it sits on, the foundations are quite wide, so it can accept a rectangular house, but the pattern is a trapezoid, which you can find in ancient sites, whether it's in England or down in South America. Even some of the doors and windows are trapezoidal shape, you know. Out west, some of the southwest, I've seen a trapezoid shape. Some of the, like, I think Chaco Canyon, Mesa Verde, or something like that. But historically, I think people would use 90-degree corners on the structures, you know, so... That was one of the things his equipment found, and as I mentioned earlier, the standard unit of measure. His equipment's so accurate that I think we're going to be able to study that a little bit more. Maybe we can actually determine whether what standard unit of measure was used to construct the site. So, but Tom is mapping things in Connecticut, up here, down in Pennsylvania, and recently I connected him with a gentleman in out in Minnesota. I think you know him, Jared Murphy. He's doing work down in Belize, and they got this big area down there. They're going to be developing it, but there's Mayan temples, and he's already taken a trip down there. I wish I could have gone. I was busy. They all invited me down there, but I would have liked to have done that. It was January when it was cold, but he went down there for several days. They looked the whole landscape over, and then they came back, and I think they got plans to return pretty shortly to start mapping some of the Mayan ruins down there using his LIDAR, you know. So I hope maybe I can get away for a couple of days and join him down there, because that would be very enjoyable to see his equipment at work.
Sounds fascinating, and he's just another one of the researchers that you've had up there who greatly contributed to our understanding of some of what went on there. We just don't know. And, you know, America Stonehenge keeps its appeal because we just don't know. And I think that's one of the interesting parts of your book is, you know, you just flat out say that.
Yeah, it's still a mystery there, that's for sure. I mean, it always has been a mystery, you know, and it still is. Slowly, it's, you know, revealing some of its secrets very, very slowly. And some of it's because of technology, like you mentioned with Tom's LIDAR. And his friend, actually, he brought up in 2020 was Doria Kutrubs, and she's from Radar Solutions International. She lives in Waltham, Mass., and she does mapping with or scanning with her equipment all over New England, New York City. She does stuff for the city, too, down there. But she's done some mapping on the site and the Oracle Chamber roof. She's done the an area to the west of the site. And I just talked to her 2 weeks ago, and we got plans to map all the underground drains. You know, it's like about nine drains from like 12 feet up to 75 feet. They're built by these people who built the site. They actually engineered them before they built the structures over them. And they had to make them so that the water would flow through them, you know, so they had to run it along the bedrock correctly so that the, you know, it's basically a storm drain system to keep the place dry. Because if you don't have a lot of vegetation and soil to soak up water, you just have bedrock. When it rains or the snow melts, you're just going to have a lot of, you know, water puddling everywhere. So they took care of that with this underground drainage system. So she wants to do that for the first time. Goodwin did some digging. James Whittall in the 60s and 70s did some digging on the drains. But nobody's ever really mapped them with this type of equipment. So that's one of her projects. There's a chamber called the Hurricane Pine Ridge. It's south of the site near what we call the Lower Well. And that was a chamber that was there into the 40s. There was a hurricane in 1948, 10 years after the very famous 1938 hurricane. But when the 48 hit, a gigantic pine tree on top of the roof of the structure, from what we know, the tree fell across the double wall path, the one that takes you up to the main site. You've walked along it yourself. And when my dad opened up the site in 1958, they had to cut part of the tree out of the way so you could walk through it. And I still have visions of that. I still can imagine seeing that in my mind from 66 years ago, you know, this summer. And I remember I think it had a hollow, part of it was hollow inside, you know, it rotted. And the guy would take the tickets he collected at the visitor center. We had, you know, paper tickets and guided tours. And the guide would walk along talking to the people. I remember one of the guides had him in his hand. He took him out, or in his pocket. He took him out and put him into the hole. I don't think he was supposed to do that, but I remember as a kid looking up, seeing that. It left an impression on me all these years later. But that's a tree that actually destroyed that structure. The first manager in 1958-59, his daughter, they actually lived in Methuen, Mass., about 10 miles south, but next door is a lake called Islington Pond. Excuse me. And they had a camp there. So they used to, all the kids down there too, a lot of them came up and played in a site, which caused problems too. You know, when you have a lot of people playing up there, it's, you know, disruptive. They take things, you know, that kind of thing. But the daughter actually remembers playing in that chamber before the hurricane hit, and it was still intact. And I just came across newspaper article from around 1938, and I hadn't seen this before. It actually described that chamber. So I'd like to have a radar over that, because in the 1990s we had more primitive ground penetration radar. And they used it on the hilltop, and it was built down the street about 1/2 mile away was where the factory was that made it. We were very, very fortunate. And they brought the equipment up at the time. It was cutting edge. But here we are 30 years later. And I told her I'd like to have her map that again and see if she saw what they saw about 30 years ago. You know, they said, they looked down in the radar, and they're looking at it going, I think you have a floor here, you know. So that would be kind of cool to do that again. And then I had that, what I think was a different type of serpent down near the watch house. I wanted to run the radar over that and identify if that wall actually crosses the path, because what we're looking at, I think, is the bottom stones of a wall, and they repurposed the whole thing and put a double wall path over what was once a wall. That, because you had been removed, you couldn't get by there, you know. So it looks like they took the top of the wall off and they created a pathway, like a later generation, you know, repurpose of that area. But the other thing I wanted to do is where we got the optically stimulated luminescence core from, right in front of the watch house is a wall. It has a hump in it. And that's where one of the cores came from. And the date on that core was 1400 AD. But the person that took it, the doctor of archaeology that took it, thought that the wall sat on dirt. And basically it's a light test. It tells you when that dirt saw the last light I'm sorry, when the dirt saw the light of day the last time, what it's thought is that they built a wall and they covered the dirt over what, you know, whenever it happened. And then in 2020, when they came up and took the cores, we got the results back 2 years later, and they said the last time that dirt saw the light of day is when they put the wall on that dirt. It was 1400 AD, so not only pre-Patty, pre-colonial, but before the time of Columbus. So this is not a historic site. It's a prehistoric site, at least that wall is. And that wall, well, we can talk about that after. But I said, no, everything up there that we've ever seen on that site, and we've done excavations and where we have run radar before, the walls sit on the bedrock. They do not sit on dirt. None of them sit on dirt up there. They sit on solid bedrock. So what I want her to do is actually to prove that. The other way of proving it is just to do an excavation and go down and go right to the rock and expose that. They didn't do that. They just took a core. They shoved the tool in. They grabbed the soil out of there. And the thing is, I think that the dirt slowly built up after the wall. It accumulated slowly. And then it sifted in between the rocks, and that's what they grabbed, you know. And then they tested it, and it saw the light of day at 1400 AD. If I'm correct, the wall sitting on bedrock, then the wall could have been sitting there for years and years and years with the soil very slowly, you know, accumulating. And the soil comes from windblown particles and vegetation decay. And in New England, it's about an inch every 100 to 125 years. And so it could have been sitting there exposed for decades and decades and decades. And then very slowly it built up. At some point around 1400 AD, it got to that level, and then it continued above that building up. And then when he took his coring tool, he got down there, grabbed that soil. And so I want her to map that with her radar. I think that will be another good piece of evidence. But it will also say that that wall wasn't built in 1400 AD. The wall was there, and then that dirt came along in 1400 AD. So the wall could be much older, you know. That's what the point of that is. So that she said she can do that too. So well, hopefully she can.
Okay. Well, you know, we'll keep that discussion going. How are you doing on time? I don't want to.
I'll tell you what. If you have another question or so, and I'll get myself ready for another day at work. But
okay,
I really appreciate
being on with you. Let's see what you. Also, kind of go into a good bit of detail about Dr. Barry Fell's 1975 visit. You get the inscribed stones and Ogun, or how Maria does the official pronunciation of Ogham, but you found that kind of writing. So if people go out and buy your book or get it from the library, this is another interesting section to pay close attention to. He gives us a lot of details. So go ahead with Dr. Fell's visit.
Right, yeah. So in 1975, James Woodall, he had been with us since the 60s. He was an archaeologist. And James got in contact with Dr. Barry Fell and told him about different sites in New England and everything. And Barry Fell originally from New Zealand, went to school, college in Edinburgh. And then he came to the States, and he was professor of invertebrate marine zoology at Harvard University. But he was also involved with ancient inscriptions in the study of those, what we call epigraphy. And so I think it was around the middle of June. There's actually a date in the book when James brought him up. And I remember being there, being told he was coming, and I remember being in the building. And for some reason, I remember being inside the building, looking out the window and seeing them walking by, heading up the site. And I must have joined with them after that. You know, I said, oh, there's a Harvard professor. I was kind of impressed. You know, I was pretty young at the time. I was around 20, 21 years old, I guess. And I was pretty impressed by this. Uh-huh. In fact, that we had somebody from one of the big institutions actually coming to this very controversial site. So Barry Fell went up. My dad, my Uncle Oz, who was very involved with the site, James Woodall. And a couple other researchers, you know, were part of that group. And we went up on the site, and I think Barry Fell is kind of blown away by the structures, because it is, of all the sites in the Northeast, there are about 800 of them, and there's some pretty amazing sites, but I was just like, the one, it's kind of unusual. It's a high density of structures in kind of like a one-acre area, as you know when you visited. And Chris Alphamat is about another 110 acres of land with structures and walls and what we call serpentine walls and with all sorts of features all over the hill. When you get to the near the top of the hill, but not quite, it's not right at the top of the hill, just offset from it. But there's so much, you know, so much construction there, you know. So he was pretty impressed by that. And when he visited, I'm trying to remember if it was the first time he came or whether it was in, that was in June, or the next time he was there a month later. But they were there, my dad found another inscription. But what he had been shown is some stones, kind of triangular shape, ones you could hold in your hand, that were found in 1967 and 1969. There were three different stones, and they're found in the area called near the Chamber and Ruins. And they're put on display in our building, our visitor center, for several years as unknown markings, you know, strange or whatever. So the public could see them, you know. And at that time, we really didn't know what they were. But Barry Fell almost immediately recognized one of them as, I think, Iberian Punic or Phoenician. And he asked permission to bring that stone back to his home. He lived in Arlington, Massachusetts. And he had kind of a, almost like a little museum set up in his house in a workshop, and he made latex moldings, you know, for these inscriptions and everything. So he brought the stone back, and he had to spend some time looking at it very carefully because they're very weathered. You can see the markings, but he had to look at, pretty hard to look at them. And then he went on to make a plaster cast, you know, the latex over it, and then he pour the, you know, peel it off and then pour the plaster into the mold, into the latex mold, I guess. My dad actually watched him do it. I didn't, unfortunately, I think I was working. I didn't get a chance to go down there and see him do this. But so he did that, and he actually, one of them said that the chamber was dedicated to Baal on behalf of the Canaanites, and it was a sun transit structure or temple, I guess. And they came back in June, about a month after his first visit, and everybody was pretty excited, you know. And he brought back Dr. George Carter from Texas A&M and his wife, Alberta, and Barry's wife, Renee, and then my dad. And we, in fact, we got a picture of all five of them standing by the Patty Chamber near the upper well all together. I was going to put that in my book, but it was kind of buried in all my photographs, and, you know, we had to get this book out. I'm like, okay, well, we'll skip it this time, you know. But in that particular visit, too, I think they found a couple more stones. I know I was with one of the researchers, and we were in the Patty area right near the Chamber and Ruins. It's a courtyard I mentioned earlier. It looks like a trapezoid, but the Patty's built a home over it. They modified it somewhat. They built a wall in the middle of the house. Today they would use lolly columns, you know, those metal pipes with cement in the middle. You know, we have them in our house to hold the middle of the house up. But they built a wall there, you know. And in that wall, we were looking, and we found an inscription, or what we thought was an inscription. We showed it to them. It turns out to be a sun symbol, and he called it, and you mentioned the word ogham, and that's what I always pronounce it, but Maria Wheatley calls it oum. Oum.
Okay.
It doesn't look like the way it's spelled, you know. And
I knew. I mispronounced it.
Yeah, and I always do, too. I go back to ogham because that's what we were saying all those years ago, but oum, I guess. And I'm glad she's around because it helps to get the right pronunciation. But so that was Celtic. And then the other stone my dad had found either on that visit or the previous one was actually Celtic also. And it was what it spelled was Bell, one line down and then two lines down without a vowel. So it was B-L, and you insert the vowel, and you put the letter E in there. So he said Bell. And then he had the other stone, which was Phoenician, with Baal, B-A-A-L. It's in the Bible, too. So he made the connection that Bel, and he always thought this, that Bel and Baal were the same god, the same deity, you know. And at our site, that convinced him that they were, you know, and that was kind of a cool thing. Well, over time, they found more inscriptions on the hilltop. And it turns out that Barry Fell said that we had not only Ogham or Oum, we had Phoenician, but we also had Libyan, So they have the three inscriptions. And he said they were all basically Iberic, basically from Spain and Portugal, the Iberian Peninsula. So that was a jumping off point. It's like when Columbus left for the New World out of Cadiz, or it's called Cadiz, I guess. One of our staff people actually lived in that city for a while studying Spanish. So I'm like, how do you pronounce that? It looks like Gades. It's an ancient Phoenician city. It's called either Gades or, and it looks like Cadiz, but she goes, no, it's called Cadiz. So anyway, I've been in Spain. I was right near there too back in 50 years ago. I was in that whole area. But so the Phoenicians were there. The Celts were there. The Libyans were in that area. And there are other cultures too. He felt there was a melting pot and that they were multilingual. They jumped off to the New World, to South America, Central and North. But these inscriptions are not only found at our site, but found basically throughout the Northeast and all the way out towards Alberta, Canada, to the West Coast, and down to South America. So it's not just our site. Vermont, by the way, in Berryfield, in one of his books came out, he identified Vermont as having the highest number of, and it was another book too that said the same thing, of inscriptions, not only in the Northeast, but even in Europe, particularly of Ogham. So places like Woodstock, Vermont, Putney, Royalton, Pulteney, Vermont, have structures, and in these structures they find all these inscriptions. So Vermont seems to have the highest number of inscriptions of any other place, you know, even at our site. So that was interesting. So the inscriptions seem to be all across the Americas. So then the question comes up, are they identifying them correctly? Are they misinterpreting them? And then the mainstream like to call these things ant tracks, plow marks, root marks, hoaxes, fakes, frauds, misinterpretations, you know. So there's a lot of explaining to do. But I can't see all these hoaxes. Some of these things are just found by luck, you know. Somebody's doing some digging and the stone comes out of the ground, you know, with inscriptions on it, you know. Some of them are in very inaccessible places. And the ones on our site just happen to be found, you know. They weren't a place where somebody would actually look up and see it. They're found in the dirt, you know. So I don't think they're hoaxes, you know, and the mainstream just doesn't want to really face what these inscriptions could represent, you know. Kind of back to 1959 or 1960 with the Vikings, you know. In 61, they proved the Vikings made it to Canada, and I visited that site last year, Alonzo Meadow up in Newfoundland. If you go back about, 65 years ago, people were still arguing whether the Vikings ever made it to the New World, you know. And then they left things behind, of course, the Vikings, you know, they left stuff behind, including possibly some inscriptions, you know. That's still being debated, too. How far west did they go and all of that? But we're kind of that way with with these markings I just told you. The jury's still out. There's still controversy. But in my book, I put them in there. We have a picture of one of the inscriptions. That's the one I think that says Tabal on behalf of the Canaanites. It's one of the typical inscriptions that we found at our site. I mean, who did that, you know, and what does that represent? I think there's something to that, you know.
You include a lot of photos of the artifacts that can be seen in the display cases in the gift shop, as well as outside photos like the fault line.
Yeah, exactly. We really, when I was working with James and my daughter-in-law stuff, we really want to show what these things look like to get a really good understanding of what we're talking about, you know. And like I said, it's worth 1,000 words. And again, you know, back in the 70s, the last book that came out was 2003, and they did include some photographs. I think they were black and white photographs. But
the guidebook?
In the book before that was, yeah, the one with David Galsworth and my dad. Yeah, Joanne's book had a lot of photographs, and then David Galsworth has some photographs. And in 1977, a book by my dad and Mark Feldman have photographs. But back then, they were like black and white, you know, and they only put a couple in the book. You know, we've learned a lot since then, you know. Thanks to all their research in the past, you know, we have all of what they learned, and it kind of accumulates, which is great. And we can learn from them, and, you know, we try to make improvements if we can. But I thought, like, even like the slab with the stone underneath it, you know, the quarried slab you mentioned earlier, there's actually 34 of those we found all over the hill, starting with that one you mentioned. The first one looks like the picture, except there's leaves, so we used this photograph. This is the one on the west side of the site. Mary Kramer, the one that sat on one having lunch back in 1982, is near the North Stone, but it looks so much like this stone, as a matter of fact. But that picture had, it was hard to see the propping stone in the picture I had. I said, why don't we use this one? It just came up on the screen. We have all these photographs. This one here is very, very visual. So this was part of the bedrock. The bedrock is foliated. You talk about the geology of the hill. This granite comes up in layers. And so either it comes up naturally from frost action and roots, or people actually work a small crack in the rock or a fissure, and they separate it, they raise it. And this stone weighs several tons. This is a huge stone, actually. And then you see the stone they stuck under it. And then if you look at the stone carefully in certain edges, you'll see the dimpling where they actually were striking it with another stone. And it's called percussion flaking. It looks like the edge of an arrowhead, if you will, the little dimpling or scalloping in it on a big scale. And so they were shaping the stone, what we call dressing the stone, using stone tools, and they propped it up so they could get a better angle at it to do that. Well, the next step would be to move the stone to whatever they were going to build. And I think this stone here is about 800 feet from the main site, and it's slightly uphill all the way. And today there's dirt everywhere, but I think if you went back 4,000 years ago, it was a much thinner soil cover or perhaps bare bedrock. And I'd rather move this big rock over bare bedrock on log rollers or something than trying to drag it on log rollers on soft earth, which would do nothing but digging, like, you know, especially when it's muddy or even if it's frozen, you know, a weight of this thing, we just press it right into the dirt and you have all that rolling resistance. So a bare rock. Plus, the other thing is, how did you find this area to take the stone and, you know, remove it from the bedrock if it was covered with dirt? So if you and I went out today looking for another area to get a slab, we'd be like, oh, this is nuts. We can see bedrock exposed, but I would say most of the hill is covered with trees and vegetation and dirt. You're like, where are we going to find this? It's all underneath the ground here. We can't see it. We know it's there. There are some outcroppings of bedrock, as we show in the photographs. But most of the hill is like that. What you see in that picture there, it's all dirt. It'd be hard to find an area and say, hey, let's work this crack in the bedrock and lift this piece of slab up, you know. You'd have to remove all the dirt to find it in the first place, you know. So we have 34 of them, and it kind of struck us recently, just a couple of years ago, that they must have had a much bigger project, because these type of slabs would be used for wall slabs, roof slabs, you know, on the main site. You know, this is very typical of a roof slab I'm looking at in this particular photograph on page 53. I know your audience can't see that, but we have quite a few of that shape. And if you look at the roof slabs on the structures, the same kind of stone, you know. So I think somebody had a much bigger plan for this place. And then you were getting to that before, like they walked away from it, you know. They just abandoned it, you know. And then maybe they never came back. Maybe, you know, obviously the last group never came back, but maybe there were groups that built it, left, built it, left, and then these last people might have had a bigger plan, and they just never finished it, like a work in progress.
I think the propped up rocks are just really add to the mystery. I think it's a fascinating subject, and you know, you're not just making that assumption based on the one sample. You said there are 34 of them found across the hillside like that. So,
so far.
yeah. It seems pretty obvious that if they're, you know, big slabs, you know, are they going to be menhirs or ceilings? So that's one of those topics that keeps me really interested in America Stonehenge.
Yeah, there's a lot of depth to the site, you know, and the more we spend time in the woods looking, the more things we find, you know, just in the last 7 years with the serpent walls and the 14 of those now, and then 26 windows. By the way, I think I got a couple more to add to that, but I got to look at them a little bit more carefully. I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but I'll go out there and look at them a little more and take some photographs of them. So I might have like 27 or 28, but we have 26, and we are going to try to GPS them this summer so we can get an accurate location of all these windows, you know, and see how they, how they're laid out across the hilltop. We're also going to do the same thing with the slabs that we're talking about, those big slabs. We want to GPS those too. That'll be interesting on a map to see all these big slabs, and they're all over the hill. And some of them are downhill, you know, up to 1,000 feet downhill from the main site, which means a lot of work to get them up the hill. But that first one in 1982, when she sat on that and recognized her, she had already been instructed by David Stewart Smith to look for something like that, you know, a serrated edge, a rock that's been raised up artificially. And she's having her lunch, and she noticed that and brought it to the attention of David and some of the other people. And they decided the next year they would do an excavation in front of it, and they did. And it was under Dr. Gary Hume, our state archaeologist. And Dr. Gary Hume is still living. He has the same last name as our Pat Hume, our archaeologist. They're both friends. They are not married. And again, she was married to a Dr. James Hume, a geologist. But and they live near each other, too. But he was a lithic specialist. An lithic specialist actually is a person, you know, that kind of specializes in the way stone tools are made, you know, the napping, you know, to make arrowheads, arrows, stone axes, stone hoes, any kind of stone tools, utensils, weapons. And he was a specialist in that. And when he was already on a couple other projects at the site. He was an outsider, mainstream, but he was willing to stick his neck out. And in 1980, he got involved. And by 1983, he was involved with that excavation and looking at the stone very carefully as they cleaned the stone up and everything. You could see the serrated edge and the little flakes that came out of it. And he said it's unmistakable that they're actually shaping this like a multi-ton. I think he said a ton and a half arrowhead. It's on our video we have in the theater, but it's also on our website. If you go to that, I mentioned earlier, it has the 11-minute video. Dr. David Stewart Smith actually mentions what Dr. Gary Hume said about that, you know, the way the stones are shaped. So Dr. Gary Hume, you know, it's not Middle Age technology, it's Stone Age technology to quarry and shape these stones. And then these big slabs, again, were going to be used for some purpose, perhaps a standing stone, like you mentioned, like a menhir, or perhaps a roof slab, or even a standing stone on its side called an orthostat, like the Oracle Chamber, the East-West Chamber has those. Even the Oracle Chamber has those on the side with the table. This big stone stood on their edge, you know. You know, David Stewart Smith, by 1989, put out a monograph, and in it, it was called Ancient and Modern Quarry Techniques. And in it, he identified by 1989, 12 years that he had been working on the site, 300 slabs within the 15-acre area. He wasn't counting the other 90 acres where that picture in the book is. That's outside of that. Of big slabs or part of the stone walls, either standing up as monoliths or orthostats or built into little structures. Outside of that, there's probably an equal number because there's stone walls outside of that that he hadn't gotten to by 1989. So that was a massive undertaking by these people to peel these stones off the bedrock and to shape them. In some instances, you can see the little serrated edges because they wanted them a certain shape. And then they constructed part of the stone wall or a structure like on the main site out of these stones. But yeah, 1989 at 15 acres, just in that area alone, he had over 300 slabs that were actually created, I guess, if you will, by man, you know, without metal tools.
Okay. And while we're talking about some of these stones, you know, you also cover Halley's discovery within the Watch House. What made her discovery so unique?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And we have photographs of the sequence of that of that, what we called an illumination inside the watch house. The watch house is just an amazing structure. It's located about 300 feet from the main site. And even Goodwin, although he focused on the main site and put up a chain link around the 1 acre area, this is outside of that. He actually, of course, looked at the Lower Well, which is, you know, closer to the main site. And he also looked at the watch house, and they did a little bit of cleaning and, you know, study of that chamber. But it's a glacial erratic that makes up the right side of the structure if you're looking into it. And then they built the chamber around that structure. There are about 50 structures in New England of that design. Glacial boulder on the right, the doorway, and the structure built on that left side of the boulder.
Hmm.
Benji Wamp, Connecticut is a big complex. It's in Groton, Connecticut, near the Navy base. It's over 200 acres. It has a lot of the features you'll see at our site and some different ones too. And they did OSL testing there, and it seems to be prehistoric, like 1400, you know, AD dates, and actually a couple older than that at Gunjiwamp. But so that structure is really cool. You know, they called it the Watch House for many years because they thought somebody was in there as a guard to keep people out of the main site except for ceremonies. So it was kind of an exclusive area, and only people could come up there maybe on a pilgrimage. And it was a lot of fanciful thinking, you know, about it. But it's actually located at the beginning of a double wall path that goes up to the main site. So that was the thought, that somebody would stay there and keep the site, you know, kind of, you know, protect it, keep people out of it until ceremonies or whatever was proper for people to enter. Well, Haley came in 2019, 5 years ago, probably April or maybe it was around March, I guess. She lives in Texas. She came up. She had already known about our site from Scott Walter's show and some other shows. And when she visited, she went into the chamber, and I was telling her that that back wall has a white quartzite stone that's been talked about for decades. And she saw it right away. When you go there, you can see it right in the chamber. And I said, there's been different people coming up with different ideas of what that stone might mean. And one of them was 1992, Hans Holzer's book, long before Columbus, was on Columbus's 500-year anniversary. And Barbara Hand Clow did the foreword. And she's an investigator, researcher. She's fairly well-known in the circles. But she came up before 1992 when the book came out and had already explored the site, visited. In her foreword, she talks about that chamber, and then she talks about that quartzite stone. She thought it might represent the eye of I don't know if it was Horus or something like that, like an Egyptian god kind of, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But she thought it had a very big significance because she commented on it in her foreword. She actually, you know, the foreword, you get in there, you tell the reader maybe why they should buy the book and, you know, that kind of thing. And that was one thing that caught her attention. You know, it's funny how she really concentrated on that. You can read it. You know, we have the book. But 1996, Joanne Lambert did our first souvenir book. Because I did mine later, as we already mentioned on the show. And her book was wonderfully written. She was a Spanish teacher, high school teacher. She did a wonderful job on it with her photographs, and she talks about that too. And she had some ideas, you know. Yeah, that same quartzite. So by the time Haley came along, we have been discussing this, and I actually asked David Stewart Smith too before his passing in 2016. I said, did you ever, when you did some restoration, there was some damage done to the right side of the watch house. Did you ever touch that stone? He goes, no, I just, on the left side of it, the stones, some were coming loose, so we kind of reset them. A little bit of damage was done there, but that stone, I haven't touched it. It's been there. So when Haley went in, she had her app on her phone called Sunseeker. I had heard of the app, but I hadn't put it on my phone. So she got against the back wall, and she sat there for a few seconds, and she, you know, lined it up and everything. He goes, I think on the equinox, you're going to see the sun come up, and it's going to go right into this chamber, and this stone probably will get illuminated, you know, on the equinox. And the forest actually, up to that point, just completely blocked the sun going into that chamber. It always has. Since we've been around since the 50s, there's always been a forest that runs right to the neighbor's yard, and then it continues, and then there's a field well beyond that. But the forest always blocked the sunlight going in there. So we couldn't see it. We couldn't check it out when Haley was there. But we already knew we were going to do a forestry project. We had already lined up a licensed forest the year before in 2018. And in 2019, 2020, the first winter, they came in when the ground was frozen, and that's when they did all their operation for about 2 months. And I had the licensed forest to make sure he cleared that out well. to the neighbor's property, and eventually they did. And so the spring of 2020 was the first time I saw that, and we had a group up there. We got there about just before 8 o'clock, and I looked in, and it was a pretty clear day, and the sun went into the chamber for the first time we've ever seen it, and went right into that rock, but not only illuminated it, but actually created a shadow and light, and it was shaped just like the top of the stone, the same shape. I'm like, oh, my God, look at that. Hmm. It's not just illuminating, it's a shadow and light effect, you know, because of the shape of the entranceway that they had built. Whoever built this chamber, they actually shaped it. How did they do that, you know? I mean, that's pretty cool to be able to do that, you know, and you're moving stones around, they're heavy and everything, but able to do that, design it, other than you might think it's a coincidence, 30 minutes later watching this thing, my daughter-in-law, Kat, had put up a camera, and she had it running for a while, but I just stood there watching it, taking pictures, and at about 8:30, it turned into, the shadow light turned into, it looked like a hand with the index finger pointed out, and pointing right at that stone, like touching it, like it was pointing at that stone intentionally. So it went from a framing of the top to that in a 30-minute illumination. And for the next 2 years, that's what we went up there and watched, you know. It was pretty cool. Last year, we went up and we saw from the main astronomical platform, we watched the sunrise over a fallen monolith. That's the first event. It's the earliest event. Then we went down to the Oracle Chamber, watched another alignment over a monolith with a little notch or a cupola on top of it, and we watched that about 20 minutes later. So we have like two events that morning. And then we went down, and everybody else saw that pretty much, and they're going out for coffee, they're going out to rest or maybe back to work and coming back for the sunset that evening maybe. So I was just standing there with the last person. It was a woman, and we were having a great conversation right in front of the watch house, and I was looking at her with my back to the chamber. We were just discussing, and I said, geez, we still got about 30 minutes before that illumination, you know, at 8 o'clock, and I just happened to turn my head and look into the chamber at 7:30, and the bottom of that stone was perfectly framed with a shadow and light, just like the top would be 30 minutes later. So he took photographs, and that's what you'll see in the book. You see the 7:30 shadow light. You see the 8 o'clock where it goes to the top. It reverses right to the top of the stone, the opposite side. It's like, that's pretty amazing. And then it goes to, it looks like a hand again, pointing back. The idea is that that chamber might represent the womb, and that stone might be an egg. And the sun, the male, the rays, the fertilization, spring, equinox. It reminded me of Newgrange in Ireland, but that's a winter solstice illumination. And I've been to Ireland, and I visited Newgrange.
Does the Newport Tower have this the illumination on the spring equinox?
I do know it has it on the winter solstice, just like Newgrange. And it's the arch, and it looks like an egg above the arch, kind of an egg shape, and it gets illuminated by the sun going through a window opposite in the tower, and on the about 9 o'clock, just like at Newgrange. I think it has to do with the angle in the sky that they wanted, because the time zone, all that, not the time zone, but the local time is something that we created, you know, the 24-hour clock and all of that stuff. But I think it's the angle of the sun. And so at 9 o'clock at Newgrange in Ireland, that sun's rising right into that window box. It goes into the 65-foot chamber in the back of its cruciform shape. Haley puts the interpretation of that cruciform shape is actually the shape of the womb. But also could be the shape of Cygnus, the swan, the northern cross. Kind of looks a little like that, too. And I've seen other cross shapes in Ireland, too, when I visited with my dad. We spent a week there looking at all this stuff. But the Newport Tower does that. But I found out more recently with Scott Walters, I guess his help and some of the other researchers, they found that May Day, Beltane, like we have at our site, the sunlight goes into a different angle, into a different window, I believe, and it strikes that same stone. It looks like an egg and illuminates it on Beltane, too. So that one I got to learn a little bit more about. So it's winter solstice at Newport Tower in Rhode Island and the Beltane alignment. And they have some other alignments here, too, at Newport. By the way, that's pretty much true south of our site, you know, the Newport Tower. very, very close to Trousseau. And Scott Walters was aware of that too. So we had that really cool illumination, but that boulder is the head of a serpent, and that was found out since 2016. And that's behind its head, the wall undulates just like you think a serpent, kind of up and down, and it's a multifunctional chamber because that boulder from the astronomical platform is actually a February 1st cross-quarter day. The sun will actually rise over that stone, and that's Imbolc by the Celts. And it's the beginning of spring, the end of winter. Today we kind of look at it like we have Groundhog's Day, and it's also called Candlemas on the Catholic calendar, and maybe some of the other religions have Candlemas.
Right, okay.
And the first hump, by the way, is November 1st, and that's called Samhain. We look at it, I used to call it Samhain, but it's called Samhain according to Maria again. And it's the first day of, it's All Saints Day, the day after Halloween, the beginning of winter, the end of fall, and some ancient cult, it's called the cross quarter day, just like February 1st is. And now, also that boulder not only is a February 1st alignment, but it's the lunar minor south moonrise standstill, which happens in coming up in 10 years. So we should be up there in 10 years watching that event. So it's a astronomical alignment with the sun. It's an astronomical alignment with the moon, too. So it's an amazing structure, and we think it's the head of a 2,550-foot serpent. And they did take the OSL test in front of that wall I mentioned in front of the watch house. That's the end of the tail. It's the last hump, 90-degree bend, and a pointed tail right in front of the mouth of what would be the serpent's head. That might be symbolic of the Ouroboros, and that's an ancient symbol of wisdom, the circle of life, wholesomeness, and it has other meanings too. So the watch house just keeps up yielding all sorts of really amazing things from our understanding. Two bones were found in there back in the, I think in 1950s. They were looked at by the Smithsonian, and they identified them as bison or buffalo bones found inside the chamber.
Uh-huh.
And then the stone and bone pendant were found at the same time. And the bone has a drill hole in it, and the stone has a drill hole in it. They were found inside the chamber, too. And you wonder if somebody lost a necklace at some time in the past, or somebody placed that in there as an offering at some point, you know? So that chamber, there's a lot going on with that structure, you know? And then most recently, we got that 1,400-year-old date in front of it, which I need to get the radar to look and see if the wall's sitting on the ground, which would indicate that the wall could be much, much older. If the wall's sitting on dirt, then Dr. Feathers could be right that the wall was built on the dirt. It started the clock then, you know. It's not that the wall was built and then the dirt came along later, building up and then sifting into the wall, which I believe is the case. And so the wall could be much, much older than that dirt was. So.
Okay. Hey, Dennis, we have about 2 minutes left. We got a bonus hour with you, and plug the conference and a book again, and we'll call it an evening.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, again. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Flowers
went by very, very quickly. So thank you. Mm-hmm. And I hope your audience enjoyed it. The book should be coming out soon. I think in the next couple of days we'll get something back from the publisher again, and they'll tell us that the book is a go. Then it'll be available on Kindle, from my understanding. I guess you go to Amazon Books, and then it will be available that way. You can have it shipped to you. I don't know if it's going to be electronic. That's something I've still got to find out. So please forgive me on that. But the book will be in our visitor center too, probably within the next week or so, which will be great for sale. And then the our events coming up with the Equinox on the 19th of March. The 23rd will be that big event with Scott Walters, Ronnie LeBlanc, and Haley and myself. And then we have the eclipse coming up on April 8th. And then we'll have the summer solstice, because that's always a big time, around June 20th or 21st. That's one of our biggest events of the year. And we have drumming circles that will be on our website. And our website, again, is stonehengeusa.com. And if anybody has questions, they can call us, or there's an email address on that, too. So,
okay.
but we're very excited about the book. So, it's been 21 years since the last book came out, so this is kind of a nice, exciting time for us.
Okay. It was a terrific book. Thank you for being a guest, and we're just about out of time. And thank you so much for listening and being a guest, Dennis. Take care, everyone.